G'day, crypto goers, investors, and Australians. I'm Adam Stokes. Welcome back to the channel. Martin North, we're so happy to have you back on. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to see you again, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to chat with you.
Martin, I really enjoyed working with you last week, and I also got a lot of great feedback from my viewers. I brought you on tonight because I want to go into another dimension of economics, that being the housing market. So by way of background, I've been investing in property for about probably the last 15 years. I have a pretty wide property portfolio across Australia. And the truth is that I haven't actually been too happy with the performance over the last few years, but I wanted to get your insight. How do you think the property market in Australia is looking for the medium and long term?
Okay, so you need to separate out property as somewhere to live, right? So, you know, shelter and all those good things where you, you know, bring your family up. And property as an investment class, right? Because the former is still, I think, relatively worth thinking about insofar that you have more control if you buy a place. But, of course, there are lots of costs involved in maintaining a property and paying all the other costs to it. But as an asset class, then you've got to think about two aspects. The first aspect is capital appreciation. And of course, if you talk to many people in Australia, they will still tell you that property doubles in value every 7 years. That is one of those pieces of mythology which is completely untrue. And in fact, if you look back over a century and a half, there are only two times where there's been a consistent rise in the capital value of properties. The first time was essentially after the Second World War, when there was a lot of rebuilding, and then we've had the run-up in the last 20 to 30 years because of the deregulation in the financial system and because of all the lending. So from a capital appreciation perspective, the sorts of things that we saw over the last 20 years is unusual, right? But if you're a property investor, you've got capital appreciation, and then you've got income streams relating to the rental that's coming in. However, if you actually do the calculations based on the net rental that's coming in, the costs of actually maintaining the properties, and the costs and all the other things that you have to take into account, right? More than half of investment properties on a cash flow basis, excluding capital appreciation, never make money, right? Even taking account of tax breaks and all the other incentives, right? So you are completely reliant on capital appreciation to be able to actually make any returns out of property. And that is something which a lot of people just don't believe until they sit down and do the calculations. And many people will not really worry about losing money on the rental because they always think about capital appreciation. But what if capital appreciation doesn't happen now for the next 10, 15, 20 years, right? Many property investors that I survey, even in the last 2 or 3 years, have not got any returns because the capital appreciation is lower than it was when they bought. You know, properties have fallen. Okay, some of them are a bit higher now, but for many people, there's not much there. And net rentals are lower now because, you know, there's an oversupply of rental property in Sydney, for example, for the first time for quite some time. And if you take Perth, for example, over there, the average rental is now 20 to 25% lower than it was 5 years ago. And that's an object lesson in what can happen. So if you do the calculations and if you compare putting the same amount of money into the stock market relative to property, actually, the stock market comes out ahead.
Yeah, I learned probably the hard way, and I was sucked into, I guess, the dream of this negative gearing thing. So with my first, property is pretty good. I bought it off the plan. I bought it at a very low price. It went up considerably before I even built it. I got the first owner's grant. I lived in it, and I made a killing on it, but I didn't sell it. And I continue to rent this property out positively geared. And I used the equity in that property to leverage off that to get the next one and then the next one. And one of the properties I bought was in Melbourne. And the reason why I bought in Melbourne is because the Victorian government was stimulating their economy by giving tax breaks to investors, essentially giving us the same deal as if it were a first home property by giving you a tax break. And that's what actually got me into the Melbourne market. Specifically, it's in Fitzroy, and it's actually a very good property. But even after leveraging off that to get to the next one, and of course where I live, bricks and mortar here in Canberra, I've actually found that as I've gone through my property journey, that positive gearing is in fact the better way to go in my experience, because with negative gearing, there's only so much tax you can claim. And I think that's where people get caught up. They think that, oh, you can claim it on tax, you can claim it on tax. And it's like, well, yes, but you can only claim back what you've paid. If I'm only paying, as an example, $100,000 a year in tax, I can't claim back $1 million in tax because I haven't paid that. But what are your thoughts on negative versus positive gearing in the current market?
Well, my own view is that negative gearing is much less attractive than it was, and that's because interest rates are so low. Right? Because essentially, the interest you're paying now is a lot lower than it was, so therefore the amount that you can claim back is lower. And of course, they've tightened some of the other rules in terms of the things that you can claim back and offset against the costs of the property. So for many people, actually negative gearing doesn't make a huge amount of sense. I'd also make the other point, your story of leveraging one property off the next property off the next property, I see that all the time in my surveys. And, there are people with 7, 8, 12, 15, 20 properties all geared off each other. Now, in a rising market, that might be sustainable. But just as you get a positive reinforcing process when prices go up, if prices start to go sideways or fall, the reverse is also true, right? So effectively, it exacerbates the risks on the downside. Now, if you're basically negatively geared in the middle of that, you've got issues. And of course, a lot of the people in this situation would have been using interest-only loans. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason you go interest-only is because you can claim the greater proportion of the payments you're making because it's interest rather than actually capital repayments. But then again, we now know that a lot of people are getting caught by being switched from interest only to principal and interest only, and suddenly the repayments go up 40%. Now, if you have one investment property, that's sustainable. But if you have 15 or 20 properties and suddenly they all go from interest only to principal and interest, you're snookered. So this whole leveraged edifice, in my view, is fraught with danger in the current environment.
Absolutely. And that's why over the last few years, I have been focusing entirely on drawing down those principles and building up the buffer for when this day comes. Yep. And I don't think it's a case of if, but rather when. And the more I can build up the capital across my entire, the equity, I should say, across my entire portfolio, when the interest rates, if they come back up again and I suddenly have to make big payments, I'm paying less on the principal. And the other thing is, if the rent goes down, it's not going to throw me off so much where I can actually afford, hopefully, to make these payments on the principal. But you mentioned also about the capital growth, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because on one hand, you go into these investment portfolios to hopefully get some of the benefits of the tax benefits. But of course, the interest rates are so low and you may not be paying that much tax anyway. So there's only so much benefit you can get there. Then you go to the other end of the spectrum. You say, well, I'll get the capital growth on it. I'll buy it today and sell it in 10 years' time. And of course, that capital growth isn't there. And even if it is there, you have this conundrum of nominal amounts versus real amounts. So on paper, you say, hey, it's gone up $100,000. But once, of course, you account for the inflation and everything that you've paid for it over that time, and of course, finally, the capital gains tax when you're selling it, if you've owned it for more than 12 months, you're paying tax on 50% of that growth. It's in fact a facade.
Yep. Spot on. So very few people do that complete calculation, right, in my experience. Most people just look at the sort of sticker price when you bought it, sticker price when you sold it, and assume that that delta is going to be positive and therefore it'll all work out. But as you say, you've got two issues. The first is you've got value erosion because, of course, inflation is running, whatever it is all the time. So the true value is actually going down. The numbers might be bigger, but the value is actually lower, right? First point. Second point is the value that you get is unknown until you actually sell the property. So it's a paper loss or a paper gain, right? But it's meaningless until you transact. And, of course, there can be all sorts of circumstances in the market at the time when you're transacting, like we might be in a recession or we might find that lots of other people are also trying to get out at the same time, lots and lots of different things. So that future value is not assured. And so if you take a risk-adjusted and inflation-adjusted view of the returns that you get, they're actually pretty frighteningly low.
And this is where I've been speaking about it on my channel. Now, of course, Martin, you and I don't give financial advice online because, first of all, I believe it's illegal, but I'm not a financial advisor and planner. And even if I were, I haven't met my audience individually, so I can't sit down and go through a financial plan with them. But what I do speak about in broad terms on my channel is about where do you put your money? So where do you invest it? Now, you touched on shares before. I got into the share market pretty much first year uni when I was about 18. And I've the best I've found, and of course there are exceptions to this rule, but I generally find between 6 and 12% is what I'm getting at best on the markets. But that's, of course, only over a given year on certain stocks. And I come across the same problem when it goes to sell it. I'm now dealing with the capital gains, particularly if it's within the first 12 months. I'm paying tax on 100% of that gain. And if I do it after the last 12 months, I'm paying it on 50% of that gain. Now, tax is as sure as death, and we have to deal with that. But the other thing I'm dealing with is the administration of these shares. Yeah. So I have a big portfolio plus my property portfolio, and the sheer administration of complying with the Australian Taxation Office laws, which I do, because I never want to be caught out and I want to do the right thing by the good people of Australia and be legally compliant. But the administrative burden on administering shares and all gains is becoming quite a headache. And of course, you get a good accountant, but an accountant can only operate with the information that you give them. Long gone are the days where you can simply give them a box of receipts, a shoebox full of receipts, and hope for the best. So then we look at gold, which in many ways, if you're trading it, it's kind of like a stock. And if you've got gold and silver and these precious metals, you have to store them if you're holding those as opposed to getting a third party to hold it. You have to store these things, and that costs money, and you need insurance, and you need space, and if you have to move, you have to carry it. So then we looked at another area, which is crypto. And you could even go say foreign exchanges, but again, you could probably treat foreign exchanges kind of like a stock. So then we go into crypto, which is a whole new world. And crypto avoids, in some instances, avoids the inflation of continual quantitative easing and pouring money into an economy. Ultimately, what I've been exploring on my channel, Martin, is where do you put your money? So if you're trying to escape inflation, you're trying to escape from the housing market, where do Australians put their money?
But you know, there's no simple answer to that question because every individual situation will be different. But there are a few questions that you can begin to think about, right? What's most important to you, right? Is what's most important to you securing the value that you've currently got, whatever that is, right? In other words, protection, right? Or is it trying to find the best possible growth? Because all advisors will always say there's a risk-reward trade-off, right? If you want high growth, you're going to have to take a lot more risk. And some of that risk potentially means you could lose your shirt, but on the other hand, you might get some upside, whereas there are other types of investments that are probably not paying anything like as much, but potentially might be less risky. But the point is, every asset class, whether you look at property, shares, cryptos, metals, or anything else, they all have risks attached. There is actually no risk-free investment. Even bank deposits are not risk-free. Bail-in, banks failing, very low interest rates, and all those things on deposits too. So the first horrible truth about investing is there's no free kick. Right? Once you actually start realizing that, then you have to go through asset class by asset class by asset class and thinking about the risks and rewards for each class of assets. Now, I can construct an argument positively why gold or silver is good, insofar that, you know, it's fungible and you've got something tangible. But I can also argue that those prices are highly manipulated because they're absolutely connected to the gold futures price, for example. And so there are billions and billions of traders around the world, you know, trading gold many times over the fundamental value of gold that's there, if you look at the amount of gold that's in existence, right? And those are manipulated markets, so the gold price is manipulated. I'd argue that the crypto price is as equally manipulated insofar that it is supply and demand. And, you know, prices go up, prices go down. but there is actually no fundamental logic as to what the value is. There's no link to any underlying. So it is actually about pure supply demand. So that tells you something about the risk reward, right? I've told you about property. I have to say also shares don't always go up. They sometimes can go down. And, you know, you've seen it, you know, last time we had the global financial crisis, shares what dropped 30%. And ask yourself this question. How come on day one, you know, the value of a share is 100, and on day two post the crisis, it's now valued at 70? How can that be? You know, how can it be that essentially, you know, you can drop that amount of value? That tells you that the value of the share is not ultimately linked to anything. It is about sentiment. And that's where I get to in all of these discussions about where you should put your money. There is an overlay of sentiment and speculation in every single asset class. And therefore, whatever you choose to do, you're always going to have to take some risk. Now, you can take calculated risks. And, you know, there are offerings out there where people say, well, we'll manage your portfolio for you. So you can basically build it into a, you know, a portfolio, and then we'll manage that for you, etc. Then, of course, you've got extra fees coming over the top. So suddenly, you then find that your net returns are lower than your gross returns. And by the way, cumulatively over years, it's very important to understand that the fees you pay along the way, whether it's share trading or whether it's managed fees or whatever, really have a huge compounding negative impact on the total returns that you actually make. Right? And I sometimes say to people when I'm chatting with them, do you know, for example, what your fees are on your superannuation? Very few people actually know. They tend to quote the gross return quoted by the fund, not the true return they get after all the fees, right? So the short answer to a long question, or the long answer to a short question, is it's very complicated and there's no simple answers. What most advisors would say is spread your risks. Don't put everything in one asset class, because some will go up, some will go down, some will perhaps go one way, like stocks and bonds might operate as a bit of an offset. It's actually quite difficult to really be able to say for sure what the right solution is, and it probably changes over the life cycle of different asset types as well. There is no thing more certain than death, taxes, and uncertainty in investing.
I agree with you about the manipulation of markets. People say, on the crypto space, they say, well, Bitcoin's manipulated, the price is manipulated. And I said, well, of course it is. And they're like, hang on a second, I thought you were a crypto guy. And I said, well, I am. But the reality is that the crypto markets, their market cap is so small, and as a result, they're more malleable. And that doesn't mean that gold markets aren't manipulatable. Mm-hmm. It just means that because there's such a bigger market cap, it's more work to manipulate it. And the analogy I give is an ocean. The ocean has these waves going up and down. And if you look at the gold market, it's a big cargo shipping container ship. And when the market waves, which is money or human sentiment, hits the cargo ship moves a little bit. And you see this ship move, let's say, 3-5%. Now put a little fishing boat on it, a tiny little fishing boat, and we'll call that fishing boat the Bitcoin markets. The same wave hits the fishing boat, but it goes all the way up in the air and comes all the way down. It's the same waves hitting those markets, but because they're smaller, the effect on those markets is bigger, but the manipulation is still there.
Well, you know, you're right about that. And I'll give you one example. I was chatting to the CEO of a Bitcoin exchange today, and there'll be a post up on the DFA channel soon, but I was intrigued to explore with him about how price discovery works with regard to Bitcoin, right? So he's got, you know, a large number of people registered on his exchange, and they buy and sell Bitcoin, right? And so I asked the question, well, when somebody actually goes to buy or sell Bitcoin, right, who's on the other side of the trade? Is it all other Bitcoin holders in the whole world? And the answer is no. It's whoever else is in the same exchange wanting to trade Bitcoin at that point in time. Right. So, in fact, you don't have a single market globally for Bitcoin, right? You have a series of individual exchanges all around. Now, I know that they're actually connected because of the way that the whole thing works, but it's actually down to the individual exchange. And in a way, that's a very important insight to understand, right? Because what it shows you is there are a whole bunch of uncertainties about value discovery, right, within the crypto world that probably people don't fully understand.
That's dead right. And that's why when you're shopping for crypto, you can look at, for example, I'll trade on 5 or 6 different platforms and I can shop around to see who's got the best price. But the laws of the market say that if site X is selling Bitcoin, I'll just make up numbers, if site X is selling Bitcoin for 10 grand and site Y is selling the same Bitcoin for 11 grand, the market shifts to site X. And that's where they sort of counter each other out. But you're right, there is no central, if you will, stock exchange.
Yeah.
And when I'm teaching people in the crypto space, there is no one site that you can buy all cryptos from.
Yep.
And even though you can buy the same crypto on different sites, this price is varying. But what I do like about the crypto space comparative to when I'm trading shares. So when I trade shares, it's kind of 9 to 5, 5 days a week, 40 to 48 weeks a year, depending which market I'm working on. And I can't trade on weekends. It's typically, depending which site I'm using, a $15 to $30 buy-in with a minimum of $500. Whereas crypto, I can do it at 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning for a tenth of a cent on my mobile phone immediately. And these dynamic markets make it quite exciting for trading crypto. But I hope not to go too much down the crypto space because I really wanted to talk significantly about housing tonight. I also want to touch on the point that you made about everyone. I'm sort of kind of paraphrasing here, but you said pretty much you've got two different types of markets, one that you're going to live in, as in a house that you're going to live in, and a house that you'll be renting out to the market.
Well, you know, it's one market, right? But those motivations are fundamentally different.
Agreed. Yep.
Yep. Yep.
So still the same market. But when people say to me, for example, some of my mentees, they say, I want to get into property. Should I get into property? And I always come back with, not a financial advisor, but we all need somewhere to live. Ultimately, yep. We need somewhere to live.
Yep.
Now, the other extension to this is I found that once you get a house, and I'm not a big fan of banks, but I'm living in reality. I'm not living in crypto la-la land yet. But when you've got a house, if I need to buy a new car, which is not the greatest asset to buy, but I also live in reality and I drive around a fair bit, and cars make me money because I can transport between businesses and so forth, and I love cars. But when I've got a house, I'm able to get cheaper money. Essentially, what I'm finding is by owning a house that I live in, excluding my investment properties, I can get cheaper money. Now, for those people who can't get into the property market, do you think this is a type of, if you will, a type of discrimination where they can't get cheap money per se?
So what you're saying, I think, let me just sort of replay this. Once you've got a property and you've got some equity in the property, that gives you access to then cheaper funds to do other things, right? That's what you're saying?
Correct. And essentially lower interest rates.
Correct. Yeah. And indeed, quite often people will pull money out of the property to fund a new car or, you know, equity drawdown, right?
Yeah.
It's about 30% of refinancing is equity drawdown, right? And if you ask people why they're doing it, it's because it's the cheapest form of funding. So if you don't have access to that pool, then you're an unsecured borrower, and that means you're going to have to pay a much higher interest rate for the similar loan if that's what you are going to do. So it does definitely does create a two-tier market. On the other hand, there is a school of thought that says in the current environment with property prices wobbling and potentially over the next 2 or 3 years maybe going down rather than up, you might do better to rent because rents are actually quite low at the moment, and use your free cash flow then to do the other things you want to do. So it's a two-way street, right? The reason that I said to you it depends on your motivation. For many people, the reason to buy somewhere to live is for security. You know, it's the cave, it's the, you know, place to keep your family, and, you know, you own it and control it. And that is probably an overwhelmingly positive thing. The financial benefit or otherwise varies on the individual circumstances. You can argue it both ways, but certainly if you have equity, you have access to potentially the magic money machine until property values start to fall.
And that money issue aside, it is reassuring, especially if you've rented for a long time, never having a property inspection, being able to hang a photo on your wall, invest in your property. If you want to paint the walls, you can just do it, or change your carpets. You know, it's your cave.
Yeah. And the point there is if you've got a rental property and the landlord decides that he wants to kick you out, right, because he wants to do something, sell it or renovate it or whatever, you know, you haven't, much less rights. There are slightly more rights now than a few years ago, but nevertheless, relative to owning your own property, you just have much less control. And many people find that lack of control and always being on the edge of maybe having to be looking for somewhere else as a very significant negative factor.
Yeah, I had a mate who was living in a property, a big property, a rural property, and he'd been there for 10 years, and he was under the impression that he was eventually going to buy it. And literally within months, he's like, no, lease is up, get out.
Yep. And that's the thing.
It was devastating.
If you've been in the same place for some time, and you might even almost forget that you don't actually own the place, right? But the fact is, landlords do have the right to be able to, you know, call the property back, and sometimes they'll do that.
When we talk about investing in fractional reserve lending, I had an interesting comment from one of my subscribers. And I found this comment quite profound. I didn't think it was fair, but I'm going to present it to you in the spirit of fairness. And the comment alluded to fractional reserve lending. So I've spoken about the issues of fractional reserve lending extensively and the moral issue I have with it. So basically, as an investor myself, an Australian or a member of the global village, what I discovered as I started buying more and more properties was that, in fact, through fractional reserve lending, I was contributing to inflation and diluting my own money. And part of the reason why I'm not really keen on getting more properties, all property market stuff aside, and diversifying my portfolio, is that the issue through fractional reserve lending and diluting the money, my own money and everyone's money. So the comment said that you and another YouTuber refused, the accusation was, or the allegation was, that you refused to speak about fractional reserve lending. I don't think it was fair, and I'm creating a platform now for you to speak about fractional reserve lending. Tell us what it is and tell us if it's good or bad.
Sure. Yeah. So the theory is that the way that banks are controlled is that they have to hold a proportion of their assets with the central bank, or a proportion of their assets to the capital that they hold. So in other words, you know, it might be an 8% or a 9% or whatever it is, right? Or it might be a 1% or a 2%. But essentially what it means is that for a given amount, they can basically multiply the amount that they can lend, but it is actually limited by this fractional reserve requirement, right? That was the way that banking was assumed to work for a long, long time. And it was assumed that there will be a multiplier effect, and that multiplier effect basically allows the, you know, amount of money to be able to be multiplied multiple times, but still a small proportion held at the central bank or held against capital, which was the control element, right? That in essence is what it's about. And so therefore there is a check and a balance on the total amount of lending that can be done, and by changing the rules, central banks are able to effectively control the amount of total amount of money in circulation, so that, you know, the money supply. Now, the problem with that is that isn't actually how banking works. Right? Banking works like this. A bank, when they want to make a loan, basically creates a book entry to be able to write the loan. That loan then comes into existence and can create then value by, for example, buying a property or creating a deposit. And essentially, it's the loan that leads and the deposit or the property follows, right? And now that was identified a few years ago. There was a very important paper written in the Bank of England. The Bundesbank in Germany now accepts this as well. It fundamentally turns banking on its head, because in the old days, you started with deposits, a proportion of that was then held, then you could lend the rest, right? So there's the multiplier effect. On this one, you start with a loan, deposits and property follow. So in a way, the whole concept of fractional reserve banking goes out the window, because what it says is that banks have the capacity to continue to create as many loans as there are mugs enough to borrow, without limit, right? Now, once they've created the loans, they still have to hold that ratio of capital. They still have to hold, in some countries, at the central banks. But that's a secondary activity. It's not a controlling activity, which means that central banks don't actually have control over the money supply in the same way that they always thought they did. it's actually about to what extent can commercial banks find mugs to borrow. And providing they can go on finding more people to borrow, they can continue to inflate their balance sheets, they can continue to inflate the value of properties, and essentially that magic money machine can go round and round in circles ad infinitum. Of course, what you're actually doing is devaluing the real value of everything in the process. Because if you think about it, you've got the same quantum of assets, but you've just got more money in circulation now. And you know, the money supply goes up, but effectively the true value just has bigger noughts on the end, but it doesn't actually change anything else, right? So, and that's the inflationary effect that we see. And, you know, there are many more millionaires today than there were 30 years ago, but that's not because they are actually richer. It's purely that, you know, the number of noughts have increased simply because of this idea of everything gets larger. And so that's how I see it. So I don't deny that fractional reserve banking is in all the textbooks. I don't deny that many people still advocate that that's how banking works. But I'm of the believer that it's back the other way. And you start with creating loans, and there's no limit to the loans that can be created. Then banks have to do book entry stuff, hold capital to be able to actually work within the rules. But if you also think about it, that tells you that the Bank for International Settlement capital rules are actually back to front, because they're engineered off the back of the loan book rather than the other way around. So deposits don't come first, loans come first.
That's right, and that's why we're leveraging off debt and the absurdity of the situation. And, you know, my big breakthrough in the financial space, primarily after getting heavily into Bitcoin, was this. So let's just do a quick micro example on that so our viewers can really get a grasp on this, and perhaps you can even guide me a bit. So we have, as an example, John wants to borrow $1 million. Yep. He goes to the bank. The bank has $100,000, and forgetting any deposit that John has. So John goes to the bank, and the bank has 10%. So they have $100,000 in reserves, and they lend him $1 million.
Well, where does that nine? They don't need the reserves to start with. So
that's right.
Yeah. So John rocks up to the bank and says, "I want $1 million." Right. The bank then effectively creates an electronic ledger entry for $1 million and pays that across to the borrower. That's the first step, right? That's an electronic entry. That then creates a debit and a credit, right? Within the banking system, then that has to be offset. So the loan becomes an asset. The bank has a liability on the other side. Now, what they then have to do is to hold a proportion of that loan, let's say 10% or 8% or whatever it is, by way of capital, right? But that
and
capital,
that's what I'm referring to there. Yeah, it's not 100%,
yeah.
Is it?
No. But it comes as a second order calculation, right? Once you've written the loan, then you have to say, right, now I have to hold this amount of capital, because that's the Basel rule. But the Basel rule doesn't stop you lending in the first place. The Basel rule forces a bank to hold a certain proportion of capital, let's say 10% or 12% or whatever it is, against the assets and liabilities that they have. And the whole point about it is this: that capital ratio is ultimately designed to protect depositors, right? The idea is that you want to have enough capital in the bank to protect depositors, because depositors are effectively creditors to the bank.
Yep.
Right. So when you put a deposit into a bank, you are an unsecured creditor, right? And so those ratios are about protecting depositors. It's not about enabling the loans to be written.
Now, we're going to link this shortly to the cash ban, negative interest rates, and bail-in laws. But to close off on this, I'm enjoying this. So in this example, we agree that there's 10% of capital somewhere.
Yep.
But the other 90%, so it's not 100% for 100%. So John wants to borrow $1 million. There's not necessarily $1 million worth of capital, credits, cash, gold, anything, Bitcoin, anything. Where the other 90%, and correct me if I'm wrong, is essentially created out of thin air, but John has to pay back that $900,000 in, if you will, real money, to money that never existed in the first place, hence creating this inflationary effect.
Yeah. So if you think of a bank assets and liabilities, right? So you've got a series of loans on one side of the balance sheet, right? They have to then have all the deposits and other liabilities on the other side, and that would include shareholder funds and other forms of liabilities, and the two have to add up, right? You still have to be able to true up. But like I said, what you've done is you created an asset and you created a liability. So effectively, you've lifted the boat on both sides of the balance sheet when you actually create a loan. That's how it works, right?
Because debits can be, or future debts can be counted as assets.
So a loan is an asset because it's going to get repaid. A deposit is a liability because you, as a bank, have to pay it back. Another form of liability would be bonds. So you will fund your balance sheet from overseas investors who give you money, or you might get money from depositors, or you might get money from shareholders. That's pretty much, all of it. All of that is the other side of the equation to balance up the balance sheet. So that's the accounting side of it, right? And then the 10%, the capital, so a certain proportion of those liabilities has to be held in essentially particular forms of liabilities under the capital rules. So there's tier one and tier two capital, and it's different types of capital, so that a certain proportion is then protected, right? And it's that's the ratio, that's the Basel rules, right, between the asset pools that you have. The other trick, of course, is that all those assets are risk-weighted, right? So, in fact, if you have a mortgage, right, you don't have to hold the equivalent of 100% capital of that mortgage. The Basel rule says the chance of that loan getting defaulted is much lower because of the security. So therefore, they reduce the amount of capital you hold. So typical, the ratios for a big bank is perhaps 30% rather than 100% of the value of the loans. So that's another whole set of issues, right? So the true amount of capital that you hold is not the total. It's a subset. And in fact, if you look at it another way, for a typical bank in Australia, shareholders only have about 5% exposure. 95% of the exposure to all those assets is all those other shareholder, all those other liability holders and bond holders and everything else, right? It's a highly leveraged model, and that's why Australian banks still are making reasonable returns. It's a highly leveraged model.
And of course, with so much leverage there, if it goes down, the flow-on effect is massive.
Well, yeah, think what happens. If in fact those loans, the mortgages that you've made, start defaulting, right, and you have to write them down, then you've got a big hole in your balance sheet, effectively, and that can then flow through, because it essentially means you don't have the capital structures that you need to be able to stay liquid and to stay afloat. And that's the risk aspect of the financial system that we have. And just as a sidebar, another category are derivatives, right? So that's another thing that banks can do. And those derivatives have even a stronger multiplier effect, because a lot of it's actually off balance sheet rather than on balance sheet. So they can have a big event off balance sheet that can create a huge liability, and that then translates through to a massive hole on the balance sheet, and again creates more risk inside the way that banks work.
And there's a visual, a really good visual, I think it's called from Money Matters, I believe. They've got this visual of where all the money is in the world, and it shows it in these little squares. And Bitcoin is like one tiny square, and gold and silver is like three or four squares, and it goes into property and cash. And then it shows the derivatives market, and it is just off the chart. The derivative markets, a market on essentially nothing, is the biggest market in the world.
Yeah, and you've got to be careful, because derivatives, we'll just spend a few minutes on derivatives because it's really important. Derivatives is based on two things: the face value of the derivative contracts that are written, right? So that's the largest amount, right? And then effectively, I'll give you an example, right? Have an interest rate swap for $1 million. The face value of that interest rate swap will be $1 million. So that's the one. That's one way of measuring it, right? But you also have it at a particular interest rate. And so, in fact, the net exposure is not $1 million. It's the interest rate at that net exposure, right? So $1 million times 5%. So in fact, the net exposure might be 5% if that's the interest rate, but it's actually offset by what the true interest rate is at a particular time. So you mark it to market, and therefore the difference in net terms is much lower. The problem is, nobody knows what the true exposure is, because it basically depends on how those interest rates move. And if interest rates move a long way, the exposure gets very big. So you'll see derivatives quoted as a gross exposure, which is a huge number. It's trillions and trillions and trillions, right? I think the last number I saw was $50 trillion in Australian banks in derivatives in terms of the total. The net amount is a lot smaller. And then the question is, well, should you be quoting the net amount or the gross amount?
Mm.
Because nobody knows whether that net amount is the right amount. You won't know until it's settled or until it's actually gone wrong.
Moving to the cash ban, when we were talking about fractional reserve lending or fractional reserve holdings, we were talking about these deposits that are needed essentially to allow future loans. So in theory, if the banks had no depositors, no creditors, no one like you and I putting money in the bank, in theory, is it fair to say that they wouldn't be allowed to give future loans or more loans?
They would be able to engineer it through various means. That they have other types of assets and liabilities that they could use in their balance sheets instead of deposits. So there are some banks around the world who hardly take any retail deposits at all. They fund the whole of their book from wholesale investors, for example. It's a perfectly legitimate banking model. Not recommended, but it is feasible to do that.
So where does the cash ban fit into this? If we've got the banks printing or creating more money and holding so much more money, and then forcing the government or creating laws where the people are going to put their money into the banks, and there's nowhere else to put your money, in the big picture, remaining neutral from the outside, even though I do have bias, but I'll try and remain neutral in this question here. Is there any good in the cash ban?
Right. So let's understand the cash ban is being presented as stopping money laundering.
Black economy.
Right? Yeah, black economy, right? Although nobody knows what the value of the black economy is, nor indeed whether this would really solve. All of the research around the world suggests that a cash ban would not solve the black economy, and it's not even a big part of the black economy, right? So the bill as it currently is being explored in the Senate says you won't be able to pay more than $10,000 in cash between businesses or between an individual and a business, right? Whereas today you can do that, right? Now, the reason that the government's going with it is because they are saying it's to do with bikie gangs and money laundering, right? But the truth is that there was a paper written by the IMF that basically said, when you get towards negative interest rates, in other words, you have to pay to keep money in the banking system. So as a depositor, you have to pay the bank to look after your money, right? Chances are most people will take the money out of the bank. Why would you pay them to store money? You just hold notes, wouldn't you, right? And so if that were to happen, you would suddenly find there'd be a run on the banks because everyone would be taking their deposits out of the banks, and therefore they would suddenly find that the liabilities they thought they had, they don't have any more. And that basically would then cascade over into this issue of, well, how do I manage my ratios to the loans that I actually have, all of that sort of stuff, right? So the cash ban could well be seen as a mechanism to make it more difficult to take money out of the banking system, right? Trap money in the banking system, keep money in the banks, in the bank deposits. That then protects the banks. And by the way, it also means that banks can then charge for all those electronic transactions, whereas if you pay cash, there's no charge for paying in cash, right? Because if it's just notes that you hand over, right? Whereas if you go electronic or even checks, there's probably a cost involved. So banks can make more money from those fees, and banks can be more protected in the negative interest rate environment. And if you go deeply negative, let's say 3 or 4% negative, right? You have to be able to hold the money in the banking system. And so the hypothesis that we're running with is that there is an agenda here to try and make it more difficult for people to take money out of the banking system and to hold the cash and transact in cash. And by the way, if you try today to go into a branch, you've got money in the bank, you know, and you ask for a large cash withdrawal, they'll probably refuse to give it to you even today. And we'll have to ask lots of questions. And the AUSTRAC rules are that if you actually pull out more than 10 grand in any case, they'll probably just alert AUSTRAC. So there are already rules in the system today that actually control, you know, large transactions above 10 grand, cash transactions. So the argument is cash ban is nothing to do with the black economy. It's more to do with negative interest rates. And there is existing legislation already in force, which is more than sufficient to track transactions above $10,000 in cash. You don't need additional legislation.
Yeah, the example I gave to Robbie Barwick is like if you and I are criminals and I'm selling you something illegal and I say, hey, Martin, I've got this illegal thing I'm selling you, and you say, cool, it's 11 grand and I give you $11,000. You're like, and could you imagine as a criminal, you're like, oh, no, I don't want to break the cash ban law. I'll break this trading law. So, I can unpick it a thousand ways, but it's absolutely absurd. If it's to stop a black economy, well, that's not going to stop a black economy.
Yes.
And that's what police are for. I tend to agree with you, and in fact, I agree with you entirely, and I see it as part of a bigger picture. And I remember actually when I recently went to a big bank, a big bank and a big branch, and I tried to get out money to put towards a car I was buying, and it was all above board. I had to actually ring ahead, and I think they wanted 3 days, and it wasn't much. I think it was about $15,000,
yep.
And they wanted 3 days notice to get my money out of a bank that they're supposed to have.
And do you know that the Reserve Bank, I think, said the other day that only about 20% of notes are actually in circulation at the moment. The rest of it is actually being held by people. So then, it's one of the reasons why many banks don't have enough money to stock up their ATMs at the moment.
Is that right? So what, then we just start printing more money?
Well, the Reserve Bank keeps printing more money, but for some, central banks around the world are scratching their head to say, who is hoarding all these notes? Where are they going? Nobody quite knows. It's not just an Australian thing, it's a global thing. And, you know, you could, if you wanted to be conspiratorial, and I'm not, but you could argue it's a sign of the financial system beginning to wobble and people losing faith in, you know, the banks and the banking system, and then preferring to hold cash out and holding it in physical notes, because at least you know that the notes are always going to be there, unless there's a bushfire and it gets burnt down.
This is really exciting and concerning at the same time. I love working with you because on one hand you teach me so much, but on the other hand you scare me a lot, because some of the conspiracy theories I've come up with or have worked with in the crypto community with, you're actually giving great insight into the facts around it, that it's not just a conspiracy in many ways. Some ways what's happening with our economy is something to be greatly concerned about. But to finish on a positive light, do you think long term that we're in for a rough ride in Australia or globally, or what is good in our economy?
Well, we're very lucky because, of course, we have these massive income streams coming in from the resources that we continue to ship out, right? That is actually what saved us, right? For every $10 up on the iron ore price, we in Australia Inc. make an additional $4 billion to the bottom line each year, which is amazing, right? So iron ore was up to 120, it dropped down to 80, it's about 90 now. So if we maintain a very high iron ore price, that will give us quite a lot of latitude to do a lot of things here, and perhaps will save us going into recession. But if the iron ore price drops, or if the unemployment rate continues to go the wrong way, of course it's a little bit better this week, but chances are I think it will go higher later. There are some worrying cracks in the local economy too. Households aren't spending, many businesses aren't investing. And we have a government who's fixated on making a surplus at all costs rather than perhaps putting a little bit more focus on long-term planning and strategy to support the economy. So we're at a bit of horns of a dilemma, right? There are lots of potential exciting things that we could be doing in Australia. We could be laying the path for a very different future, or we could be doing more of the same old, and essentially muddling along for another 2 to 3 to 5 years. My worry is that we're in the muddle along path rather than actually breaking out and essentially taking a new direction. But my belief is that there is actually a different story that could be told for the Australian economy, which is a very positive one. Unfortunately, a lot of the focus, I think, is on the wrong things.
I'm confident there'll be a political revolution in our lifetime. And with that political revolution, I'm sure there'll be an economic revolution that comes with it. Martin, for my viewers, how can they find more information from you?
Okay, well, you can always find me on my YouTube channel, Walk the World. We put up daily posts there. And I've also got to my blog at digitalfinanceanalytics.com. And you can also find me on Twitter at DFA Analyst.
I'll leave those links below. Martin, I really appreciate you joining me tonight. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed the conversation. Cheers.